The coronavirus outbreak is threatening global supply chains for cars, clothing, smartphones. There's another crucial one at risk right now, the world's pharmacy.
China controls about 90% of the global supply of the core chemicals to make medicines.
Also on the show today, 5 years on, a Russian assassination remains unsolved. Who killed political activist Boris Nemtsov?
One of the things about Nemtsov's slaying that shocks the conscience was how brazen and how public it was. You know, he was killed on a bridge just steps from the Kremlin.
And villages and towns across France are facing a huge problem. Nobody wants to be the mayor.
I have no clue what the mayor responsibility or help is. I don't think people are informed enough of how much work it is.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for making it today. Muslims across the globe have been planning for months and saving thousands of dollars for this moment, the Hajj pilgrimage to holy sites in Saudi Arabia. It's an obligation for able Muslims to make this trip at least once in their lives. But this year, with the coronavirus, plans may change. The Saudi government announced a ban on foreign pilgrims to its holiest sites. Sheikh Yasser Hadi was planning to visit Saudi Arabia. He's a Muslim theologist in Dallas, Texas.
I don't think there's anything that can explain to you what those crowds are if you've not been in one. I've done around 20 pilgrimages in my life, and let me explain to you, there are crowds there that you have never seen. The diversity, the sheer quantity of people, the chaos that ensues, because as you're aware, people come from all over the globe. There's language barriers, there's different ethnicities, and of course, the spaces are very tight. So you're talking about 2 to 3 million people going to around 5 or 7 sites where they keep on going place to place, and they're all walking or on motorbikes or on buses or on cars. And the crowd is absolutely overwhelming.
Right. So what is your reaction to the news that Saudi Arabia says it will not allow Muslims from other countries to Mecca and Medina?
Well, do realize that this is not a permanent ban. Right now, we don't know what's happening with the Hajj. This is a temporary ban on some countries for the Umrah. Anytime you go outside of the mandatory season, it's called an Umrah. So we're kind of in limbo. We don't know what's going to happen when it comes to the Hajj season in 3 months. We don't know yet. So we are confused. We are flustered. We are a little bit worried and scared all put together.
What is your biggest worry? What are you scared of?
I'm organizing a pilgrimage. I organize pilgrimages and hajjis, and I'm taking a group of 150 American Muslims for the pilgrimage, actually more than that. And if that's canceled, it's going to be very disappointing for all of us. Like it's a genuine worry that people have saved for years. People have wanted to go for the pilgrimage, and that's not going to happen if they do plan to cancel the pilgrimage.
What happens to all that investment that they've made? Is it just kind of up in smoke?
I think we're going to get a large amount of refund because they're not going to be going. So I think that's not the issue. The issue is the psychological impact. Now, in America, we don't have a visa quota. We can go any year. But do realize for most Muslim countries, to get the Hajj visa is not necessarily something that is going to happen anytime they want it. It's a quota system. And so you have to apply for the Hajj visa. It is potentially possible that if they don't go for Hajj this year, they might not be able to go for a number of other years, despite the fact that they got the visa this year. So I don't know how that would work out in other countries.
We know generally that viruses spread easily in crowds, and everything we know about the coronavirus suggests it thrives in a crowd. Had you worried about this before the outbreak?
So around a decade ago, there was a meningitis outbreak, and there was a lot of concern that meningitis might be causing issues in the Hajj. And the Hajj ministry required all of us to take special shots when we went for the pilgrimage, and they continued to require that for a number of years. So this isn't the first time where these types of fears have occurred. However, I think obviously it's understood the coronavirus is at a different threat level, and understandably, there's a lot of consternation amongst all of us, myself included.
We should really make clear that cleanliness and hygiene is a central kind of tenet of Islam, like 5 times a day, right?
Muslims are definitely people who are very concerned about physical hygiene. By the way, there's a very interesting point here, and that is the face mask. When you're in pilgrimage, when you're actually wearing the pilgrimage uniform, a lot of people will be hesitant to wear a face mask. And I think Saudis have to take that into account, because technically speaking, you're not supposed to cover your face in the pilgrimage. You're supposed to show humility. Your hair and your face for men should be open completely to show your humility to God. And even though, of course, medically speaking, you would be allowed to take any means necessary to protect yourself, so there's no problem to wear a face mask, medically speaking, still a lot of pilgrims would feel uncomfortable or awkward that they've spent so many thousands of dollars, and now they're being told they have to wear a face mask, and they might feel a pious inclination to not do so.
So while the decision to ban many foreign pilgrims to Mecca might upend your own tour plans, you kind of understand the rationale.
I fully understand it, and I will respect any decision that is made in good faith. And these are difficult times, and these are new threats, and we want to protect the people. And in our religion, God is forgiving and merciful. If we're not able to go for Hajj, then it's not going to be a burden on anybody. We firmly believe that God does not place a burden on us more than what we can bear.
Sheikh Yasir Hadi, a Muslim theologist in Dallas, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
One of the hard, sober facts of the coronavirus outbreak is this. Its epicenter is in the world's second largest economy. China supplies the world with so much stuff, auto parts, high-tech components, furniture, you name it, and pharmaceuticals. Many countries are deeply dependent on China for medicine, the United States among them. Rosemary Gibson is author of China Rx, The Risks of America's Dependence on China for Medicine. I asked her just how reliant the U.S. is on China for drugs.
We're so dependent on China for medicine that if they shut the door within months, our hospitals and pharmacies would be seeing shortages, because China controls about 90% of the global supply of the core chemicals to make medicines.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty high dependency. And the Food and Drug Administration says it identified about 20 drugs that are solely sourced for their active ingredient or completely manufactured in China. What are those drugs and how critical are they for Americans?
The FDA hasn't released that full list, but we do know that there's a tuberculosis drug, priamycin, that is solely sourced in China. The other thing that we see is that when a single plant may go offline in China, that could trigger a global shortage. That happened with a very important antibiotic several years ago.
Are there any shortages of drugs or things that we know are a direct result of the outbreak of coronavirus?
In terms of medicines, that has not been reported. And I believe that companies would be very reluctant to say that in a public sphere, so as not to cause panic and also, you know, price gouging.
So one result of the COVID-19 outbreak is that the FDA can't go to China to carry out its routine inspections of drug and medical supply firms. Apparently about 100 scheduled inspections for February and March have been put on hold. How do you feel about that?
It's a problem, certainly, but I think this is just a sign of the time to come. I believe it's going to be months before FDA inspectors will go to China, because the infectious disease outbreak is going to continue. And the other reason is inspectors volunteer for these assignments. They can't be required to say, you have to go to China. And I think it's been challenging for them to have employees choose to go there, just because it's a very long trip as opposed to doing an inspection in the United States or Western Europe.
So I was just reading that there is no penicillin manufactured anymore in the United States. When did this manufacturing shift to China of medicine happen?
The biggest shift began to occur after the U.S. opened up free trade with China in 2000, and it joined the WTO in 2001. In 2004, the last penicillin plant closed. Around that same period, the last vitamin C plant closed. The last aspirin plant closed.
Well, Congress seems to be taking notice of this dependency. Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri has introduced a bill to reduce U.S. reliance on China for its prescription drugs and other medical supplies. What would you think really ought to be in a bill like that?
The bill should include funding for public-private partnerships to invest in advanced manufacturing of essential generic drugs completely made from beginning to end, no dependence on any country, and then make them available to government departments such as the Department of Defense, the VA, and the Strategic National Stockpile, at least to get started.
So how much do we rely on China for the manufacture of drugs and medical supplies that are needed to treat Americans who may be exposed in the future or contract COVID-19?
For patients who are seriously ill and require hospitalization, which thankfully is a very small percentage, for medicines to be sedated if you have to be on a ventilator or if you have shock or have serious bacterial infection, 90% of the raw materials to make those basic generic medicines depend on China sources.
So what are you most worried about right now as the coronavirus outbreak continues to unfold?
What I'm worried about is that we will not use this as an opportunity to make the investment in domestic manufacturing. If we don't do it now, where there's at least sustained interest for several weeks, I'm not sure if we'll have another chance to do it in advance of another event that will surely occur.
Rosemary Gibson, the author of China Rx, The Risks of America's Dependence on China for Medicine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can imagine how stressful it must be working in a ward with coronavirus patients. In China, medical professionals have been combating the disease since December, and many care providers are fried, physically and emotionally. Some of those health workers are reaching out to telephone hotlines for support, and the counselors who answer are not always in China. Erjing Sui is a Seattle-based psychotherapist. She volunteers for a crisis hotline called Yang Xin Kang Yi. That translates to use heart to fight the virus. From her base in Washington State, she's taking calls from medical workers in China who need emotional support.
Some of the calls that we're getting are health workers being very stressed out, very exhausting. Some of the calls that we get, some people were suicidal when they were on the phone because they're so stressed out. They're worried about their families because when they work in the hospitals, they have to stay away from families for safety reasons.
And how busy is the hotline?
Asking for mental health, it's more of a newer idea, especially using a hotline to call. There still need to be a lot of awareness created. Medical staff right now are so busy. They're fighting just days and nights. So we might anticipate some of the psychological stress or feelings might come up even later after the crisis is gone versus right now when we're in the midst of them.
So if you get a call from somebody in China who is completely overwhelmed, the doctor, say, who's been working several 24-hour shifts, how do you respond to them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So you want to provide a space, an emotional space for them. They're probably not looking for any type of advice, at least right away when they pick you and they're really overwhelmed. So our number one thing is to provide the space and see how we can support them. If we feel like they are also overwhelmed to a point, you know, we're not sure if they're safe, we'll also do some assessments to see if further steps need to be taken.
So basically the number one thing is not to really give advice necessarily, but to make people feel comfortable that they can talk. Is that helping?
Yes. For example, there is a nurse calling to say they can't sleep at night because they're so anxious, right? And typically, you would think they would just go to sleep and recover. But if they can't sleep due to anxiety and stress, that's not good. But after they talk with us, they feel a little better and went to bed. So that's something that we could do.
Well, that definitely scans with this hashtag, how to deal with feeling very anxious at home. It's been trending on the social media platform Weibo. So there's anxiety, as you say, but after several weeks in self-imposed quarantine in an apartment, what does boredom do to one's psyche?
There was a lot of discussion of like what you can do at home. If you're at home all day, what are some things that you could do to feel more productive instead of, you know, thinking about the coronavirus and worrying about it all the time.
We've also heard that people, in addition to calling crisis hotlines, that people are turning to friends and relatives for support. Do you think this human connection is maybe a silver lining to this dark coronavirus cloud?
Of course. I think human connection is everything. Professional support can only do so much, right? And that's when the human connection that we have around us are the people that surround it every day and really know us. And if you're lucky that you have loved ones that can support you, of course, that would be my number one choice.
Erjing Sui is a psychotherapist in Seattle, where she's been volunteering to pick up the calls on a crisis hotline from medical workers in China. Erjing, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Europe's most polluting power plant says it'll stop burning coal next year. That is 4 years ahead of a British government ban on coal in the UK. The Drax power station in Yorkshire, England, has been shifting away from coal for the past decade. Today, the company's CEO, Will Gardner, announced what he called the end of coal at Drax.
This is a major milestone on our journey to becoming a carbon negative company. In the course of 10 years, we will have moved from reporting emissions of more than 22 million tons of CO2 per year to zero.
The move mirrors what's happening all across the UK. The country that unleashed big-time coal burning during the Industrial Revolution is among those moving away from it the fastest. Government taxes on carbon, subsidies for renewables, and an influx of cheaper gas have all offset dirty burning coal. Today, the UK gets just about 2% of its electricity from coal. The Drax power plant still operates. It's just using a different source of fuel, wood pellets.
So these are the wood pellets.
Tour guide Jane Breach says they look like something you might feed a horse.
So we call them pony nuts.
Those pony nuts are sourced largely from American lumber, but the folks at the Drax power plant say their new operation is carbon neutral. Here's CEO Will Gardner again.
By converting Drax power station from coal to sustainable biomass, we are now close to completing the largest decarbonization project in Western Europe.
Critics say burning wood encourages deforestation, and that is not the definition of carbon neutral. Some studies have found burning wood adds carbon to the atmosphere in the short and medium term. But if forests are replanted sustainably, in the long-term battle against climate change, that's still better than continuing to burn coal. You know those stories about estates or old farms across Europe in need of caretakers? Well, in rural French towns, you might start seeing stories in a similar vein, the need for a mayor. French voters are heading to the polls soon to elect new mayors and city councils. But in many French towns and villages, the races are anything but competitive. In fact, it's not unusual to find towns where nobody is even running. And that is an existential threat for these places. Rebecca Rossman begins this next story in a small village in Normandy, where the outgoing mayor is desperately seeking a successor.
Serge Tugard is the mayor of Faugernon, a hamlet of 250 people, 2.5 hours from Paris.
Bienvenue, on va aller dans mon petit village.
He takes me around the medieval center with charming winding roads, a beautiful Gothic church that dates back to the 12th century, and a 1,000-year-old fortress.
Une ancienne forteresse.
Faugernon is about as rural as it gets. No cafes, no restaurants, not even a pharmacy. Tugal is proud of the place he's been running for more than 12 years. But he has a big problem. The 71-year-old is determined to retire from his post as the mayor.
Actuellement, à Faugernon, personne veut être maire.
But he says, as of now, nobody wants to replace him. If he can't find a successor, the town runs the risk of disappearing from the map. Literally. Faugernon is one of dozens, if not hundreds, of French towns and villages facing this predicament. In some regions, around 40% of towns don't have a single candidate to replace the outgoing mayor.
It becomes a very desperate sort of situation.
Philippe Gurry settled in Faugernon 10 years ago. In Faugernon, there are 11 spots on the local council and an additional post for mayor. Only 9 candidates are on the ballot, and nobody is stepping forward to be the new mayor. If posts remain vacant come mid-March, Faugernon will likely be swallowed up by another town.
I don't think too many people want to belong to another commune.
Gurry is one of the 9 people on the ballot, though he doesn't think he's up for the task of mayor.
I have no clue what the mayor's responsibility or help is. I don't think people are informed enough of how much work it is or what the daily tasks are.
These are important questions, especially given there's no salary for French mayors, only a monthly allowance which varies depending on the town's size. In towns like Faugernon, the mayor gets around 500 euros a month for what's basically a full-time job.
It's not enough.
Evelyne Girardin is the outgoing mayor of Saint-Martin-de-la-Lieu, a nearby village.
Most of the mayors are retired or they have another job, so they have enough to live, but it's not a normal pay.
The 65-year-old says the French government should turn mayoral posts into full-time salaried positions, like in Germany, to attract better talent. After holding an open house, Girardin managed to put together a team of candidates, including a mayor, in December. But she's worried the incoming team lacks the necessary experience. None of them have worked in local government before. The new incoming mayor is a farmer.
They don't know exactly what to expect. They don't know at all. and I'm afraid of that.
Back in Fougernon, it's another quiet day in town, and for the outgoing mayor. Still, Serge Tugard says his duties can be anything from getting a herd of cows off the road to knowing how to manage the town's yearly budget, about 200,000 euros. That pays for things like village road repairs and an annual village celebration.
Être maire, bon, c'est une responsabilité surtout morale.
Tugard says being mayor is a moral responsibility. From the moment you wake up in the morning, you're thinking about the village. And there's always something that needs to be done. Without new people stepping up for local government posts, Tugard says he thinks the village will likely disappear within the next 10 years.
Le village a une histoire très ancienne. La forteresse a 1000 ans.
This is an old village. It's 1,000 years old. We don't want to lose that history, he says. That's why Tugard says he'll spend the next month continuing to call up local residents, trying to convince somebody to embrace the title of maire. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Fougernon, France.
In Africa and the Middle East, locusts are continuing to swarm. Fatouma Saïd with the UN Food Agency explained the scope of the problem.
To give you an idea, a locust swarm that is as large as 1 square kilometer can eat the equivalent of a food of 35,000 people.
All of this is raising the risks of famine, but there's a new weapon in the fight. Ducks, 100,000 of them. Why a duck, I hear you ask? Well, a single duck can eat more than 200 locusts a day. By way of comparison, a chicken only eats about 70 locusts. Good to know. The locusts have crossed into Pakistan, and neighboring China is offering to send some ducks. But there's a question about whether the ducks can withstand Pakistan's arid climate. So, start small. First, there will be a trial run. If that goes well, a Chinese official says, hordes of ducks could be sent to Pakistan's most impacted areas. You're listening to The World. U.S. forces in Afghanistan rely on local interpreters, and not just for communication.
These guys are really, honestly, entrusted with their lives and that frequently put themselves in harm's way. I know in my case, on multiple occasions, my life was saved by my interpreter.
But those interpreters are targets, and the visa program that could give them safety has a huge backlog. That story just ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. President Trump wants out of Afghanistan. How that could happen remains unclear. It could lead to a lot of collateral damage. Consider the thousands of Afghans who helped the U.S. military. A U.S. withdrawal could expose them to revenge from a newly empowered Taliban. The World's Monica Campbell reports on the impact through the eyes of one Afghan man who helped the U.S. Mohammed only wanted to use his middle name. He says he now feels increasingly trapped in Afghanistan with no clear exit.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me? Poor connection. Hold on.
I'm connecting to Mohammed over Skype, trying to at least. He lives in an armed, walled-off compound in Kabul. We finally connect. Is this a better connection?
Yes. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Mohammed's life changed after a cricket match. It was 2006 in Afghanistan, and he was translating the match into English through a loudspeaker. Members of the U.S. military were at the game, too, and after, Mohammed says a few guys came up and asked if he wanted to work for them.
They need somebody who is really good in English, and they want the interpreter to work as translator.
The job paid well and offered the promise of a U.S. visa, called a Special Immigrant Visa, or SIV. It's for people in Afghanistan or Iraq who've helped the U.S. military and face danger because of their work. Mohammed is one of those people. But he's been waiting for a visa for nearly a decade. Getting it is urgent. The work he does makes him a target of groups like the Taliban. And he tells me about this one time when he arranged a meeting between top U.S. officials and tribal leaders. The media covered it, and there was Mohammed on TV.
Everywhere. Even we were on CNN, too.
After that, he started getting death threats.
I got anonymous calls and said that, hey, you know, we saw you on television, and when we catch you, you will surely be killed, and they would slit my throat.
Today, Mohammed helps the U.S. train Afghan National Security Forces, and he lives with them on site. He visits his wife and children in secret when he can tag along with an armed convoy leaving the compound. They'll drop him off at a remote spot near his family's village.
There can be a quick Taliban checkpoint anywhere. We hide our faces while walking and traveling and telling nobody about our movements.
Despite the danger of the work Mohammed does for the U.S. military, his visa application continues to be delayed. He feels abandoned.
Why are the delays?
Hearing about these delays makes David Smythe angry. He was with the U.S. Special Forces in Afghanistan and worked with interpreters. He doesn't know Mohammed, but he says the work that people like him did was crucial.
These guys are really, honestly, we're trusted with our lives and that frequently have put themselves in harm's way. I know in my case, on multiple occasions, my life was saved by my interpreter.
While Smythe is now safely back in the U.S., Mohammed and thousands of others like him are stuck in Afghanistan. At least 15,000 visas are still pending. Approvals have plummeted under the Trump administration.
The delays in the process are not acceptable.
That's Betsy Fisher. She is with the International Refugee Assistance Project.
Government data shows that it still takes several years to process the average application.
Her group sued the State Department to speed up processing delayed visas. A judge ruled in their favor and recently gave the U.S. government 30 days to submit a plan to do that. The State Department wouldn't go on tape, but a spokesperson sent a statement. He said that they take the threats people like Mohammed face seriously, but that processing the visas can take time. For Smythe, there's no excuse for delays on visas for the locals who worked with him.
They're in it 100% of the time, and the threat to their families and to them is real. So their only way out after serving for so many years is the special immigrant visa.
While he waits, Mohammed works at the security forces compound, still under a U.S. contract. And I ask him, why doesn't he quit working for the U.S. government? He says that won't solve anything. His links to the U.S. military won't go away.
We are imprisoned and we feel, you know, more Americans than the real Americans. We help them. We save the American lives. Our future is no future here. We do not see it here and we can't make it here.
Especially now, he says. His resume is stacked with jobs linked to the military at a time when he says the Taliban is regaining power in Afghanistan and vilifying people like him who helped the United States. For The World, Monica Campbell.
It's been relatively calm today in New Delhi. This week, though, close to 40 people have been killed in Hindu-Muslim clashes there. Tensions have been simmering for months because of a law passed under Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government and his party, the BJP. The law provides an express pathway to citizenship for many religious minorities, but not for Muslims. That could be a problem because India will soon have a national registry to check documents, and now many Muslims in India are worried they'll be declared illegal migrants. Nabiya Khan is a Muslim student in Delhi. She's been protesting the new law.
It's not like I have joined the protest. It's like it's my fight. It's like I am fighting for my identity. I am fighting for my own existence. It's like no one can come and question my citizenship in this country. I was born here. My forefathers were born here. And now some government is coming and they are asking me to prove my citizenship. It's the government that should prove that they are Indian enough, not us. It's a democracy. People have voted them into power. Okay, they don't have the right to question us.
Well, when there's a risk that your citizenship will be taken away, I suspect that that prompts a lot of people to get out in the street and protest. Describe just the scene today when you were out in the streets protesting. What was that like? Just tell me what you saw.
We have been protesting since December, since 10 December. Every day we are doing it. This is like a sit-in protest. It's a major roadblock in the national capital. So people are there in large number every day, like at least 7,000 to 10,000 people come there every day.
Wow, that's enormous.
Yeah.
So when you're on campus, what has the tension been like when you're not protesting? How are Muslim and Hindu students dealing with each other right now?
See, the thing is, there we have a lot of Hindu population who are protesting with us for, you know, saving the secular fabric of this country, for saving the constitution. But then there are people who are against us, who threaten us and who try to, you know, build any kind of violence.
How safe do you feel right now as a Muslim student in New Delhi?
Police doesn't leave any stone unturned to suppress our protests. They throw tear gas shells on us. They throw stun grenades on us. What they did while all this attack was happening, they just kept watching. So this shows that how Islamophobic our police is, how discriminatory our police is.
What does an India actually look like under the new citizenship law? I mean, for you, what are you most worried about?
Basically, the idea of, like, you know, BJP is of Hindu Rashtra, where Muslims have no place, right? Where Muslims, where they treat Muslims as a second-class citizen. They never took Muslims as citizens of this country. They take Muslims as some other, like the other. They have been treated as the other. So what they want to do is they want to systematically alienate Muslims. From 2014, when they came into power, they basically normalized the hate towards Muslims in India. And now what they are doing is they are legalizing that hate.
Do you still feel comfortable in India?
To be very honest, not anymore. Like, I don't feel safe. Like, it's like I am an identifiable Muslim. I wear hijab. I cover my head. I am the most vulnerable person in India right now. When I go out, it's like I am always scared that someone will attack me for my identity. Someone will lynch me for my identity. And no one will bat an eye. So it's like I will be killed someday and people will justify it.
Will you continue to protest even with the risk of more violence?
We have seen violence before that, but then this is the worst that happened in my lifetime. But then we were being detained, we were being lathi charged, we were being tear gas was shelled upon us. But then people are very much determined to not stop these protests until these acts are being revoked, because it's about their existence. So yeah, I think people will continue it. Even protests are being continued even till now. I was in a protest today as well.
Nabiha Khan, a student in New Delhi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Czech city of Prague renamed one of its streets today for Boris Nemtsov. It happens to be the street where the Russian embassy is located. Nemtsov was a Russian opposition leader who organized widespread protests until he was shot and killed on the edge of Red Square in Moscow 5 years ago today. Many suspect the Kremlin was behind it. Daniel Balson is the Advocacy Director of Europe and Central Asia with Amnesty International.
First of all, the Russian government has failed to come up with a credible explanation for Nemtsov's death or conduct a meaningful investigation. But what really matters here is that Putin assumed the post of prime minister first in 1999. So over the past two decades, he's seeded the system that he controls with incentives and expectations. Whoever pulled the trigger and ordered that the trigger be pulled had ample reason to believe that this deed would be rewarded. And that's really a tragedy that is separate from the killing of Boris Nemtsov. And it's a tragedy that affects all Russians.
So 5 years on after Nemtsov's death, what's the status of his case now?
In 2017, five Chechen men were jailed for killing Boris Nemtsov. Amnesty International has documented credible allegations that two of the men were tortured into confessing for their role in the murder. So there's clearly some serious procedural ethical issues with the way in which this investigation has been conducted. And we really don't have substantial answers regarding what happened to Boris Nemtsov, who pulled the trigger, why, and who ordered it.
I mean, the Boris Nemtsov case gives us pause today, but Russia's human rights abuses are really not the thing people are focused on when it comes to the Kremlin's dark side. It's really the continued meddling in U.S. elections. Why should Americans be just as concerned about human rights abuses in Russia?
Different people have different ideas of what the statistics look like, but let's say some very large percentage of the Russian population disagree with the policies that the Kremlin is undertaking. That means disagreement with the Kremlin's foreign policy, the Kremlin's domestic policy. And they bravely, at great personal risk, voice their disagreement. They voice it by going out to protests when they know these protests will be violently dispersed. They brave these risks while posting online when they know that such actions can and have in the past been punished by incarceration. So they want to see a different trajectory for Russia. It should not be the U.S. policy, the U.S. government's policy to stand aside while people who oppose some of the Kremlin's worst excesses, worst instincts, and worst human rights abuses are thrown in prison and sadistically beaten and, as in Boris Nemtsov's case, killed.
So, Daniel, you're testifying at the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission about Russia's human rights abuses. What will you be talking about? And if lawmakers are listening, what do you want them to hear?
I'm going to be speaking about the Russian government's policies in occupied Crimea. I think this is deeply relevant to what happened to Boris Nemtsov. One of the things about Nemtsov's slaying that shocks the conscience was how brazen and how public it was. Putin's government has long made an implicit, if exceedingly crass, bargain with the public, and it's that the worst excesses of the Kremlin's governance will be kept away from their view. And so it's possible to arrest, torture, and kill scores of gay men, as has happened in Chechnya, and it's possible for the security services to surveil and silence an entire ethnic community like the Crimean Tatars in occupied Crimea. My goal in speaking with policymakers is to say that, you know, these actions are related. What's happening in Crimea right now is the Russian government's active campaign to silence an ethnic group of individuals called Crimean Tatars who are opposed to Russia's occupation of Crimea, annexation of Crimea, and policies in Crimea.
What is your prognosis for how human rights in Russia kind of straighten out? I mean, is it all dependent on Putin in power?
This is not a question of members of Congress passing one bill and this problem going away. This is a question of working with like-minded allies, with retaining credibility in multilateral institutions to push Russia to change. But of course, ultimate decisions about how things will transpire, rest in the hands of Russians and Russian officials. And everybody understands this.
Daniel Balson, the Advocacy Director of Europe and Central Asia with Amnesty International, speaking with us about the human rights situation in Russia on the anniversary of the death of Boris Nemtsov. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
Traveling the world has never been easier. Just get out Google Translate and you know exactly what that foreign menu says. Google Translate is now expanding.
Bir, iki, beş,
altı, dönüş yukka.
Today, Google added five new languages, Kinyarwanda, Odia, Tatar, Turkmen, and Uyghur. Out of those Uyghur, the language spoken in northwest China caught my eye. 12 million people speak it. More than 90% of them live in China, where Google Translate is banned. And that, of course, raises the question, who will be using Google Translate for Uyghur? Maybe it's a PR move. Not long ago, Google caught a lot of flack for trying to launch a censored search engine in China. So supporting the Uyghurs in China, even linguistically, is something of a rebuke to Beijing, which has been waging a brutal crackdown on its Uyghur minority. Then again, maybe this is simply about Google expanding worldwide access to language. A quick footnote, the world receives funding from Google. Big weekend coming up for the Democratic presidential candidates. South Carolina voters will weigh in on who they think the nominee should be. The Democratic Party is hoping for a clean vote. No tech problems, no issues with voter registration, no foreign meddling. These are all big concerns this year. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou is at the annual RSA Cybersecurity Conference in San Francisco and has been speaking with government officials and election security researchers about threats to the 2020 election. Lydia joins us now. So, Lydia, RSA refers to the RSA encryption technology that was built by the company RSA Data Security, and they co-sponsor this conference. What are you learning, Lydia, especially about the concern around voter registration systems?
Election security is top of mind for many people here. And I'm learning a lot about the threats government agencies and private companies are thinking about as we're heading into next week. One of the people we heard from is Chris Krebs. He's the head of an agency within the Department of Homeland Security that's responsible for securing federal elections. It's called CISA. That stands for Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Chris Krebs said that leading into 2020, his agency really ramped up their efforts to try to find the most vulnerable parts of our election system.
The areas where information is centralized and it's highly networked, that's where a lot of the risk is. And what is that? Voter registration databases.
So, Lydia, why are voter registration databases such a big concern?
They're a big concern because we know that they were a target in 2016. And we know that Russian hackers tried to get into voter registration databases in many states. And in at least a couple of cases, they were actually successful. I've been speaking to many people at this conference, and they all seem to think that we are better prepared than we've ever been to prevent these sorts of attacks because there's a lot more collaboration between local, state, federal officials and the intelligence community about these threats. There are also things like cybersecurity trainings for local election security officials who are really the first line of defense here. Here's Director Krebs again with CISA.
2016 was the first time, I think, for the elected officials, for the American public to truly understand that cyber could destabilize a democracy. And that's where we are right now.
Lydia, we do continue to hear big concerns about election security from lawmakers in Washington. What are some of the other potentially destabilizing things people at this conference in San Francisco are worried about?
One of the things that I've been hearing about is concerns about voting machines. I visited this thing here at the conference called the Voting Village. Basically, it's this room, a bunch of voting machines that are being used in elections in the U.S. are there, and people can go and, you know, play with them, try to hack them. One of the people who started the Voting Village, his name is Hari Hursti. He's a Finnish computer programmer and security researcher, and he heads this company called Nordic Innovation Labs. And this is what he told me as he was showing me all the voting machines.
These machines were designed at a time when cyber war was science fiction. The security has not been really a consideration in these designs. Some of the newer machines have introduced more security, but security is not something you can add afterwards. Security has to be part of the specification. It has to be part of the very DNA of a design. Unfortunately, these machines don't have that part of DNA.
So Marco, as he said, a lot of these machines are old. A lot of them are running on old software that makes them really vulnerable to hacking and also to glitches. This is something that security researchers are worried about, and it's why they've been pushing to have paper backups that we can audit.
The good old paper ballot. Finally, Lydia, how big of a concern are the types of disinformation campaigns we saw in 2016?
There's still a really big concern. What we saw in 2016 was Russians working for, you know, the now infamous troll farm, the IRA, the Internet Research Agency. They weaponized social media to divide Americans on issues that were already divisive, like immigration, gun rights. Officials are really worried about more advanced social media tactics, like using, you know, more sophisticated technology to spread these divisive messages. One last point I want to make, Marco, is that it can seem overwhelming to hear about all these threats to our systems. But the fact that we're talking about them is a good thing. And the election security researchers who know about, you know, some of the scariest threats out there, they'll be the first to tell you that that should not discourage anyone from voting. Ultimately, the goal of these foreign interference operations is to undermine trust in our democracy. Letting the threat of interference prevent people from voting, that just achieves the goal of Russia or whatever other adversary we're talking about.
The world's Lydia Emanuelidou at the RSA Cybersecurity Conference in San Francisco. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
75 years ago this week, the final throes of war were unfolding on a small island in the Pacific.
And there it is, Iwo Jima, 8 square miles of volcanic rock.
The island lies 700 miles south of Tokyo. It was the first part of traditional Japanese territory to be invaded by U.S. forces in World War II.
The greatest United States force ever assembled in the Pacific closes on Iwo Jima. 800 ships and thousands of small landing craft head for the island.
Japanese resistance was ferocious and lasted more than a month. Iwo Jima became a symbol of honorable defeat for many Japanese and the futility of war to others. 21,000 Japanese fought there, only 1,000 survived. Kei Kanai was one of them. In a documentary a few years ago, he described being trapped with a comrade under crumbling rocks. I kept telling him not to give up, says Kanai, that we would find a way out. But the other man said it was hopeless and begged Kanai to shoot him. Kanai said he could not. No human being could do such a horrible thing, he said. Casualties on the U.S. side were also heavy, but the battle included this iconic moment.
On February 23, 1945, the Marines raised the U.S. flag atop Mount Suribachi as a signal to the troops below that the mountain was won. That flag was seen around the world.
That image of Marines raising the stars and stripes was one of the most famous of the war. The problem is, the island is not called Iwo Jima.
Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus visited the island of Iwo To, formerly known as Iwo Jima, March 21st for a ceremony commemorating the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Iwo Jima.
That's a U.S. Navy public affairs program from 2015. Yes, the correct name for the island is Iwo To, not Iwo Jima. Both names mean sulfur island. It is volcanic. But there are two ways to say the word island in Japanese, To and Shima. The island's inhabitants called it Iwo To. The confusion arises from the fact that the kanji, or Japanese letter, for island is the same for both To and Shima. A Japanese commander looked at the map and mistakenly started saying Iwo Shima. The Americans simply copied them and softened Shima to Jima. Then in 2007, Japan changed the name back to Iwo To at the request of the locals. That angered both Japanese and American veterans, even though to date, no one has suggested changing the name of the battle. It's still the Battle of Iwo Jima. That's where we leave you today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.